Thank you for tuning in to the WOLA podcast, Latin America Today. It's Monday, April 23rd, 2012. I'm Adam Isaacson, a senior associate for regional security policy here at WOLA. Last week, WOLA released Beyond the Border Buildup, a 60-page report on security and migration along the U.S.-Mexico border. The report is the product of a year-long research project and is available free on our website, www.wola.org. On Friday, we had an event in the offices of the House of Representatives as part of our report launch. Over the next hour, I'll play the audio from that event. The speakers are me, Maureen Meyer of WOLA's Mexico program, and Jennifer Podkuhl of the Women's Refugee Commission. Next time you hear my voice, it will be me speaking last Friday, talking about what is actually in the new report, Beyond the Border Buildup. I'm Adam Isaacson with the Washington Office on Latin America. Thank you so much to all of you for coming. I'd like to thank Congressman Silvestre Reyes's office for reserving the space for us and helping to host this event. I'm here with Maureen Meyer, my colleague from the Washington Office on Latin America, senior associate for Mexico policy, as well as Jennifer Podkuhl from the Women's Refugee
Commission.
And it's great to be here. We're just launching a report that came out yesterday. It's called Beyond the Border Buildup, Security and Migrants along the U.S.-Mexico Border. It's based on a year of work that we did, trying to figure out, basically starting with the fact that there has been a historic buildup in the U.S. security presence along the U.S.-Mexico border, the 2,000-mile border that we share with Mexico, as well as on the Mexican side. It started really during the Clinton administration with some of the first border security operations. It accelerated significantly after the September 11th attacks. It accelerated even further, bringing the curve even more steep after about 2005-2006 with the Secure Fence Act, and then a year or two after that with the Merida Initiative aid package to Mexico. We wanted to sort of set out, after all this rapid growth, we wanted to set out and take stock of what had happened, what impact that is having on security and along the border, what's the real impact, and what's the impact it's having on this population of hundreds of thousands of migrants, people who, for a variety of reasons, are still coming across the border. We did this in conjunction with the Colegio de la Frontera Norte, the College of the Northern Border, which is a think tank based in Tijuana, Mexico, and a lot of their work is reflected in this report. And the work we did, I mean, I actually have worked on security in all of Latin America and not so much on the border, so this is a big learning curve for me. We spent much of the year here in Washington, digging through lots and lots and lots of primary documents, a lot of them we'd obtained ourselves, and interviewing people here on the Hill and as well as in DHS, DOD, and other agencies. We went to the El Paso Juarez border twice. We went to San Diego and Tijuana once and Tucson and Nogales area once. And in all of those field trips, we rode along with the Border Patrol. We talked to activists, academics, defense lawyers. We talked to the Mexican authorities on the other side of the border. I got to visit Fort Bliss in El Paso and talk with the U.S. military there. We talked to sheriff's deputies and other law enforcement experts. And this report is sort of the very complex picture that we came away with. If I had to sum it up in 3 points, what we've concluded after this year, I'd say first, a real theme has been diminishing returns, that after this buildup, we can sort of stop now. We may have to for budgetary reasons anyway, but additional resources devoted to border security are going to yield much fewer returns, and in fact could even be counterproductive. Second would be that there have been side effects, and we discuss a lot of those side effects for the migrant population, side effects for the role of our own military security intelligence agencies along the border. And third, and sort of related to the first point, I think it is time that we stopped, took a deep breath here, looked and took stock of A, why we don't have a single border security strategy as a government yet and what it would look like, and B, where are we spending our resources, and is it the best way? And we'll get into that a little in our discussion today. I think each one of us will talk roughly 10 minutes, and then I'd love to have a more of an open question-answer discussion, conversation with all of you. First, the buildup, the security buildup of the last 10 and really 20 years. If you look at the report, it goes on really at length of sort of agency by agency about what has been done. It's almost a laundry list of agencies that we have there, but it all needs to be discussed and accounted for and described. Probably the most prominent is Border Patrol, which has doubled in size just since 2005. It's quintupled in size since 1992, excuse me. It has grown far faster. The Border Patrol, as most of you know, is responsible for border security between the 45 ports of entry, the official border crossings along the border. At the ports of entry is a different agency, the Office of Field Operations within Customs and Border Protection, which actually has not grown anywhere near as fast as Border Patrol. Even though the majority of drugs and arms and even migrants often go through the ports of entry. We found a host, in addition to this profusion of new agencies, we found a host of new military roles, two National Guard deployments just since 2006. The active duty military having a $10 million a year mission at Joint Task Force North at Fort Bliss. We found growth in the use of drones. And other high technology. We found states-owned, particularly in Texas and Arizona, states-owned border security budgets and programs, a lot of it with federal money being increased. We obviously have seen a sharp increase in aid to Mexico, almost $100 million to its Migration Institute alone since 2008. And a sort of a profusion, not just of law enforcement and military, but of intelligence agencies. Just about every agency we looked at, FBI, the various components of CBP, Homeland Security writ large, ICE, they all have an intelligence component, often with field offices and fusion centers and other efforts to try to build databases and learn about what is going on at the border. And you see sort of this spaghetti-looking graph that we made of what some of these agencies look like. Almost all these are intelligence, and this graph leaves off all the field offices, in fact. There's a lot of overlap, a lot of attempts to sort of join the fire hoses of information that every agency has, but not a real systematic sharing going on. It's a very confused, and you worry that the big picture, nobody has the big picture, and a lot is being missed. Now, why has this buildup happened since, especially over the last 10 years and before? Obviously, electoral politics play a role, but there are four threats that everybody cites. Terrorism, drugs, spillover of violence from Mexico, and migrants are sometimes called a threat also, obviously. Of those four threats, we found that three of them either have not materialized or they've actually reduced in the time that we were building up, and only one is constant. The one that is constant over time is actually the flow of drugs. Despite all of our efforts, if you measure drug seizures, they're way up. Since 2005, except for cocaine, which is not produced in Mexico. It comes from elsewhere. They're way up, which indicates if we accept the dictum from Border Patrol that fewer apprehensions of migrants means that there's fewer migrants, we have to assume that more seizures of drugs indicates that there's more drugs, or at least the same amount of drugs, which means that drug traffickers are not at all being deterred by this security buildup. Obviously, no terrorists have been detected trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border with intent to do harm to U.S. citizens or property. There was, of course, the 1999 Millennium Plot in Canada, but nothing like that on the Mexican side that has ever been reported. To our surprise, actually, we found very little spillover violence coming from Mexico, despite the crisis that has made some of Mexico's border states and cities some of the most violent places in the world. Right across the border, some of the U.S. cities are actually some of the safest places in the United States. The most striking example, of course, is El Paso, Texas, Congressman Reyes's district, where the homicide rate is less than one per 100,000, which is the lowest among all cities over 500,000 population in the entire United States. Right across the border, visible from El Paso, almost everywhere you stand in El Paso, is Ciudad Juarez, which in 2010 probably had the highest homicide rate in the world. Why is that violence not spilling over? You see similar phenomena in San Diego, or in certainly in Arizona. to a lesser extent, but still a significant extent in East Texas. Why? In El Paso, and actually elsewhere too, in San Diego we heard this too, from law enforcement, the theory is that the drug traffickers themselves make a big effort not to cause any trouble on the U.S. side of the border. As one sheriff in El Paso, who we cite here, said it, after the September 11th attacks, the United States closed all ports of entry for Mexico for several days. You know, we closed all our airports, everything. During those few days, Mexican narco traffickers lost tens of millions of dollars because they couldn't get their product across. As I said, the majority goes through ports of entry. Nowadays, the traffickers do not want to trigger anything that would cause a new closure of ports of entry. And certainly, a shootout on the U.S. side of the border would trigger that in that area. They do not want to do that. And that was the most frequent explanation we heard for why violence is not spilling over. Obviously, another factor is the buildup of U.S. security presence. You know, you've got a place, a lot of these cities do have the highest proportion of police and other law enforcement per population, but this is the drug trafficking, drug traffickers behaving themselves thesis is the one we heard the most. Also, the fourth threat, if you want to call them a threat, migrants are actually down by 61%. Apprehensions of migrants are down by 61% since 2005. We don't know how many people have actually tried to migrate. There's no way to know that. But the number that are being caught is far less. And that tells us about trends, and that trend is down very sharply, migration from Mexico, Central America, into the United States. Why is it down so sharply? We found three reasons. First, yes, the buildup has had an effect. Obviously, there's more fences, more officials, more presence, and that has a deterrent effect on migration. But it's probably not even the most important factor. Most of the dive in statistics of new migration happened after the United States economy imploded, especially the construction sector, which hires a lot of recent arrivals. That is a huge factor. Word gets out there are simply no jobs to be had here. Another factor is danger in Mexico, on the Mexican side of the border. The power, the control that organized crime has in a lot of border communities in Mexico, and even along some of the key routes from Central America to Mexico, means that your chances as a migrant of being kidnapped, extorted, perhaps even tortured and raped along your journey are much higher than they used to be. That has an enormous deterrent effect also. What we did find, though, for whatever the reason, with less migration, obviously there's diminished returns to any increased spending on the border buildup. Look alone at the ratio of apprehensions per Border Patrol agent. 20 years ago, your average Border Patrol agent, if you divided it out along the southwest border, was apprehending more than 300 migrants a year. Because there were so many. That's one a day. By 2000, that had gone down to 200, and last year it was 20. In El Paso, it's 4. So if you keep pouring money into that aspect of the buildup, you're just not going to see much in terms of increased payoff. And as Morgan will discuss, there are also externalities and side effects to this.
Well, thank you. Adam, and thanks for everybody for coming, and also thanks to Kim Krasovic from the Ford Foundation for being here, who's also supporting this important work. I think beyond looking at what the buildup actually looks like and who's there, the other part of the study and why we did it principally was what is the impact on the migrant population. I think what we found is that whether by design or default, migrants are increasingly caught in the middle of the buildup on the border, and it's having serious consequences for their safety. Our colleagues from COLEF did a lot more looking at the Mexico side, which I'm going to summarize here and then look at the U.S. I think in Mexico it's important to look at Mexico's government's kind of acceptance of its inability to control the southern border of Mexico with Guatemala and Belize, and because you can't really have checkpoints there, they basically have what's considered a vertical border, which means there's checkpoints for migration status throughout the country. What this has led to in a lot of cases are migrants using more remote areas to travel to the northern border, or traveling on the train, which I think is more commonly seen, of migrants traveling on the top of the train to kind of avoid highways and other checkpoints. I think what this has meant is that migrants are more easily targeted by criminal groups, one, because they're in some of these more remote areas, or two, because they're easily spotted on the train routes and everybody knows where the cities are, where they're stopped, et cetera. The other aspect, which is certainly linked to what Adam mentioned about the violence in Mexico, is what we've seen and everybody's heard is the expansion of organized criminal groups in Mexico, particularly in the last few years, and what has led to not just working on drug trafficking, but obviously groups getting more involved in other illicit activities, including prostitution, extortion, and kidnapping of migrants. I think that's been the most outstanding part of what we've seen in Mexico, looking at migrants in transit in Mexico, is this expansion of kidnapping, particularly of Central Americans, being held for ransom. Usually they would kidnap them and call family members in the United States to request ransom, and for migrants who can't pay, often tortured, sometimes killed, and either that or co-opted into working with the kidnapping rings themselves. The Mexican Human Rights Commission actually started focusing on this issue about 2 years ago and estimated about 20,000 kidnappings of migrants in Mexico per year. The number doesn't seem to have been going down, mostly by criminal groups, but I think what's just as alarming is a significant number of cases where Mexican officials are either involved directly in the kidnapping rings or the migrant testimony saying, well, we know the police saw us go by and didn't do anything, so also, you know, passing a blind eye to the situation in Mexico. Even more surprisingly from this study is that the COLEF does a survey of migrants on the northern border of Mexico, and what they're finding is more and more Mexican migrants also being subject to kidnapping particularly before they cross the border, which is more looking at being fooled by their smugglers of, we'll keep you in these safe houses until we find enough people to cross the border, while in the meantime they are actually held against their will, where they're calling their family members in the United States again for getting more money and ransom. I think probably one of the most telling examples of the security challenges facing the northern border of Mexico and then migrants on the border is that when we went to Tijuana, we visited the Grupo Beta, which are Mexico's search and rescue groups. They look and rescue migrants. And they said they couldn't take us on a tour between Tijuana and then east, which is going towards Mexicali and that part of the border, because it was getting dark and they don't patrol after dark because of security concerns. They said that the area between Tijuana and Mexicali, it's called La Rumorosa, it's referred to in the report, there's a mountainous region, it's a big area for criminal gangs and kidnapping rings. And if the search and rescue guys don't go, then what does that mean for the migrants that are actually there and trying to cross the border in areas between the different ports of entry? Groups in Mexico, shelters particularly, have seen more and more cases where migrants are not reporting kidnapping because of the involvement of officials, particularly municipal police, in the kidnapping rings. I think there's the issue of migrants happen in kidnappings and other abuses happen against migrants in Mexico because they can, and the issue of impunity and very few cases actually being investigated. In fact, the Mexican government itself, in one report that it issued, had only sentenced two people for the crime of kidnapping in a three-year period in Mexico between 2008 and 2009. Again, I think extortion of undocumented migrants is also becoming more and more common, particularly deported migrants by mostly municipal police and immigration agents. Migrants that are deported into Mexico are very easily spotted between either the clothing they're wearing, the fact that they have all their belongings in these plastic or paper bags. A lot of times they don't have their documents with them anymore, so they're easily targeted for extortion, particularly by Mexican officials, for the most case, and criminal groups. And I think that's the other concern, of looking at the safety of the border cities themselves. Going into the United States, I think the big conclusion is that abuses don't stop at the border. And I think most groups would look, and Jennifer is probably going to go into a little bit more on this as well, what border organizations and shelters in Mexico have documented is what they would consider an increase in abuses against migrants by Border Patrol agents and other officials, particularly in the detention and deportation process. Abuses including, you know, denial of sufficient water and food, but also physical, verbal, psychological abuses, dangerous deportation practices, what we'll go into a little bit later, separation of family. So I think there's the concern that as an organization, WOLA is focused a lot on human rights violations in the region by security agents and not so much on the U.S. side, but I think there's certainly a source of concern looking at the treatment of migrants by Border Patrol agents in particular. Other, I think, types of dangers are what has been an impact of the security buildup on the border is migrants are increasingly using more and more smugglers to get across the border. Smugglers cost more. It's about at least doubled since 1980 in terms of the fees charged for Mexicans to cross the border. For Central Americans, it's even more than that. And I think at the same time, and something that we found in the study that deserves more attention, is how much are human smuggling networks working with organized criminal networks, or are they becoming one and the same? I think we found that it differed amongst the sectors on how much people would say, yes, there are no groups independently operating to smuggle migrants in the United States, to areas, I think particularly the Tucson sector, where we heard repeatedly that nothing crosses the border without the organized crime group, the Sinaloa cartel, basically knowing about it. And I think there, where you had accounts where weeks where migrants weren't allowed to cross the border because drugs are being crossed, to accounts of migrants being crossed into the U.S. side to distract Border Patrol agents while drugs then are subsequently crossed. And I think just as concerning is that because migrants are going towards more remote areas, in particularly the Arizona sector, they're in contact more and more with drug traffickers. And because of the traditional routes used to traffic drugs, which are in these more remote areas, so you're putting migrants in concerning risky situations, looking at the criminal networks that are operating in the same areas. I think related to that, and I think one of the other concerning findings in terms of the impact on migrants is the increase in deaths of migrants. I think that's obviously been something that's been covered several times, but what we found more concerning looking at recent results is that, and it's in the study, while the last year, fiscal year, deaths, and this is in the Arizona case, actually decreased slightly for migrants, if you look at the number of deaths compared to apprehensions, so migrant deaths compared to 100,000 apprehensions, the number is actually increasing. So what that suggests, and I think what's been documented, including in GAO reports, is that migrants are going towards more and more remote areas of the border to cross. And I think that, again, is a direct kind of result of the closure of more and more routes for migrants as we're putting them more and more at risk. The other aspect, I think, of the study that we wanted to highlight here in terms of the situation of migrants are U.S. deportation practices or repatriation practices that we find concerning. One, in terms of, I think, the more routine, the Mexican government would say probably, practice of violating the agreements in terms of what times of the day women and children can be deported, people being deported after dark, including women and children, and also men as well, but also a newer program, which is considered part of the consequence delivery system in terms of Border Patrol, which is having a consequence for the legal actions, which is a program called Lateral Repatriation. It's actually ATEP, Alien Transfer Exit Program, which is very hard to track. There's not very much information about it, but it's it basically means that if you are a migrant and picked up perhaps in the San Diego sector, if it's possible, they will repatriate you through Texas as a way to disconnect you from the smuggling network that brought you to the United States and make it more of a challenge for you to re-enter the United States. The concerns we have on this are multiple in terms of, one, lack of transparency about the program, about who is actually can be subject to these type of repatriation practice, the separation of families and people's traveling companions. All of a sudden, you're in a whole area of the border that you don't know, and you don't know anyone else there as well. And I think thirdly, and this reflects the security situation in Mexico, is that we are repatriating migrants to cities that are considered very dangerous by U.S. and Mexican authorities. If you look particularly at East Texas, which Adam mentioned earlier, all of the border cities on eastern Texas, Nuevo Laredo, Matamoros, Reynosa, have been, you know, targets of U.S. travel warnings in the past few months. And these are areas where we're placing migrants into cities that are very dangerous. There's a lot of concern about how much state control there are over parts of these cities, and also where there's not as many social services as you might expect in other border cities. It's kind of surprising to think that Ciudad Juarez, which is, you know, one very high levels of violence and right now isn't place where there's high levels of deportation, actually has a better social service network set up to attend to migrants than a lot of these smaller cities that never had a tradition of having very many migrants deported, so there's no migrant shelters, and there's very little even services from the Mexican government to receive this population. So our concern on particularly these deportation processes, that they're unnecessarily putting migrants at risk to be particularly targeted by criminal organizations. I think particularly if we look at the Tamaulipas border, so Nuevo Laredo and cities like that, where there's several accounts of migrants being targeted by criminal groups, particularly for extortion or other abuses. I think just to kind of wrap up the study and what our main conclusions are, and if you want, I can just kind of go over all
go for it, yeah.
As Adam had mentioned, the main things looking at the buildup itself is that obviously there's a need to have a more comprehensive border strategy, a national strategy addressing border and border security, which doesn't exist currently. What we had found is the only comprehensive strategy that focuses on the border is this the ONDCP's Southwest Counter-Narcotics Strategy, which actually does incorporate the different tasks of all of the different U.S. agencies, but there nothing else exists for security itself, and let alone migration. The other is obviously that additional resources for security on the border are not needed. I think the idea of diminishing returns and really questioning what would be the added value of any more investment, and that if investments do occur, they should be at the ports of entry because of the need there. And if you're looking at concerns of where illicit goods and are trafficked, it's much more through the ports of entry than in between them. And also looking at the how do you plan to reduce the Department of Defense's role, internal role on domestic affairs, and how can you effectively transfer a lot of these surveillance capacities and otherwise to domestic law enforcement. I think that's the kind of other in terms of U.S. policy. Looking at the Border Patrol, particularly in rescuing migrants, that we had found that if you can increase resources to the Border Patrol's search and rescue, the BORSTAR agents, it's actually been found to have a better chance of decreasing migrant deaths. There's been studies that show that if BORSTAR agents actually attend to migrants in distress, the chance of death is lower. So increasing U.S. Border Patrol resources towards search and rescue missions, also increasing, obviously, water stations and beacons. But I think just as importantly, how do you have a better agreements to work with the humanitarian groups that do a really important work to search and rescue for migrants on the border, both in terms of cooperation with U.S. authorities and in the case of Arizona, the Tohono O'odham Nation, which is actually the size of Connecticut and probably the most deadly, where you've seen the highest number of migrant deaths is within the nation. And the nation itself, unfortunately, does not allow humanitarian groups to operate there in terms of water stations, et cetera. So looking at ways to address this concern. I think the other, in terms of Border Patrol, and Jen can probably talk more about this, looking at internal, external accountability for Border Patrol agents and stemming abuses. In terms of Mexico and U.S.-Mexico cooperation, how do you expand effective cooperation on the border, but also ensuring that our cooperation to Mexican security agents, including the Immigration Institute or police, is directed more towards enhancing accountability because they are some of the more abusive agents of, in terms of migrant abuses are at the hands of immigration agents and police as well. The other is obviously what I had mentioned earlier about adjusting U.S. Repatriation practices to avoid family separation and putting migrants at risk. So I think those are like our main conclusions, and we're very happy to have Jennifer Podkul here. That we had asked her to kind of complement our study and comment on it based on the work that they've been doing on the border as well.
Thanks. First, I wanted to start by congratulating WOLA and their partners on this report. It's really comprehensive. It's well-researched. It correlates with a lot of the research that the Women's Refugee Commission has done. We are a New York-based organization. I'm stationed in the D.C. office. We work on detention and asylum issues, issues affecting vulnerable migrants that are coming to the United States and also leaving the United States. We partner with organizations here in the United States along the border. We partner with organizations in Mexico and Central America doing research and advocacy work. So we spend a lot of time visiting places, researching migrants while they're detained, and then upon release of detention to find out about conditions and how policies have affected them and their families. And we focus mostly on women and children and families. Any of the policies that affect specifically women, children, families affect, you know, all sorts of migrants. So we really kind of cover the gauntlet of who might be affected. You know, one of the things that we thought was particularly interesting in this report is that the decrease in the number of migrants who are coming. The report cited that there's been a 61% drop in apprehensions of migrants on the southwest border between 2005 and 2011. This is incredibly significant, especially when you look at the rhetoric in terms of who, you know, what they say, who's coming, what a danger it is, why we need to have so many boots on the ground, right, is the language that they're using. The one thing that is really interesting also about this is that although there's been an overall decrease in the number of migrants who are crossing, the number of children who are being apprehended here in the United States is going up dramatically. Let me just give you a couple numbers. In the past few months, we've been talking to Health and Human Services, and that's the agency that's tasked with caring for children who are apprehended here in the United States and for caring for them. Normally, they take in 7,000 to 8,000 undocumented children annually. This number has jumped in the first 3 months of 2012 by 77%. Also, the number of children who are being apprehended in Mexico and by the Mexican organization DIF and through their shelters has almost doubled just in this year as well, just in the first few months of this year. So it's really significant. Nobody knows why the number of children is increasing versus the number of adults that's decreasing. But that's something to think about when we're talking about how all of these policies on both sides of the borders are affecting migrants, really thinking about who are these people that are coming across. Many of them now are unaccompanied children. The other thing that we found through our research that correlates with the findings that are in this report is that the people who are coming here, this group of people is different than who it used to be. It used to be a lot of kind of younger people looking for economic opportunities here in the United States. Now the kind of people who are coming here to the United States, most of them have been lived in the United States for many years. They may have left for family reasons, for economic reasons, for various reasons, but most of them are coming back to reunify with family members who are here in the United States. So that's really significant because the thing is the policies are still trying to address the old kind of migrants that we have, people who are coming here for the first time seeking economic opportunities, and it's not really addressing the kind of people who are coming here who aren't going to be deterred by policies such as Operation Streamline, where they criminally prosecute somebody for reentering the United States. These people are not, if a parent is coming back to get their child who may have been left here in the United States, who may have even ended up in foster care because the parent was deported, these people are not going to be deterred by these kinds of policies. There really is kind of this revolving door right now that's going on. And so the U.S. And the sending governments as well really need to kind of reconsider these policies and address thinking about who are actually the people who are coming, why are they coming, and what can we do to help facilitate this and reduce the risk to the children and adults who are migrating. The things that we found particularly interesting in this report are the effects that all of these policies have on the migrants. Maureen mentioned how a lot of these migrants are now kind of being funneled and pushed into the Arizona desert and how dangerous and deadly this is. Obviously, this is a concern. And this lateral repatriation program, it's making people not only separating families. Through these programs, agents are intentionally separating families. So when we're interviewing migrants after they've been removed, they're in a city that they don't know. They might not have had any of their documents or belongings returned to them when they were removed from the country. They may be in a dangerous situation, like Maureen was saying, because they're in a more dangerous city than they were before, and they have no idea where their families are. So, in fact, the U.S. government is making people even more vulnerable than they already are, leading to riskier things, leading to probably higher risks of human trafficking, and making them more vulnerable to the organized crime that is along the border. Maureen mentioned that the repatriations, the United States has a number of repatriation agreements with Mexico about how and when they're going to remove people from the United States. Some of the agreements, the local agreements, specifically talk about women and children and how they should not be removed during the night for obvious reasons. If you go on CNN's website, CNN International, they just have some footage of buses of women and children who are being deported at night. So obviously the U.S. is ignoring these policies. And the thing to think about is all these policies that I'm talking about, the idea is we want our borders safer in the United States, right? That's the big concern. That's why there's so much money that's being poured into this agency. It's the largest law enforcement agency in the country because we want this. None of these policies are making the United States any safer. We really need to take a good look at Is the money that we're spending worth it? Is there other ways, are there better ways of spending the money that's really going to increase our safety? Increasing money and resources at ports of entry, like Adam talked about, to really stop the flow of goods that we don't want coming into the United States. Really taking a good look at this. I think what's happened is, after 9/11, everybody was so afraid, and everyone's happy to spend money in the border and spend money in the border for safety. But we haven't stepped back and really looked at, is this making us safer, and how is this affecting U.S. citizens, right? Many U.S. citizen children who have parents who are migrating back, is this helping them? Is this helping other aspects of our country? The problem is also is that there's so little accountability for this agency, for CBP particularly, here in the United States, thinking about U.S. policies, and we've really let them... We've given them, you know, blank checks, given them lots of money, and we haven't asked them to see what kind of accountability they have. For example, if you wanted to file a complaint against the way you were treated by a Border Protection agent, they have a brand new form that they did, and it's online, and it's in English and Spanish. Well, if you've been detained by a Border Patrol agent and you're in a holding cell and they're mistreating you, you don't have access to the internet. Even if you're then sent to an ICE facility where you're going to be held while you're fighting your immigration case, you don't have internet availability in those facilities either. So it's not a meaningful way of filing a complaint. Another way of making a complaint is through DHS's Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. This is an organization, they have very limited investigative power, and they're not an oversight agency. They're within DHS, and they don't really have any authority over CBP, so they're able to make recommendations. So if they find rights violations, they're able to make a recommendation to CBP, but we have no idea how that recommendation would be received and what sort of changes CBP has made to their policies or their practices based on these recommendations from the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. So this is incredibly concerning. Recently, we testified at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights held a thematic hearing on this issue. And the commissioner from Border Patrol who came, he said, well, the majority of our complaints come from other CBP officers against an offending CBP officer, which obviously was incredibly concerning. I think he said 75% of those complaints. So what that says to us is that the people who are being victims of these rights violations are not able to make these complaints. And I think we can all suspect that law enforcement agents are probably very reluctant to file complaints against their colleagues, their coworkers. So if they are doing this, they must be very egregious complaints that they're filing. The other thing is that there's been very limited access to civil society to how Border Patrol works, kind of their inner workings, their policies. So for people who do want to file complaints, we don't know what their policies are, so we don't know if they're violating any of their policies. Wola got great access. They were able to take tours. They were able to visit a facility in El Paso. So they had some great access, but that's unusual. Civil society has had very limited access to information about how the agency works, what their hold facilities look like, what their policies are for these facilities. And so that's something else that's very concerning. So I think the takeaway message is that we have an opportunity right now to kind of step back and look at all this money went into it. They've hired an incredible number of people to work for their agency. Is this really working? Is this the strategy we want to keep with? Or are there other ways that we could be spending our money? Or are there questions we want to ask the agency to ensure that they're really doing the best job that they can be doing to make the country safer, which is their job, not to make lives harder for either migrants or U.S. citizens who are living here in the United States? So I'll stop now, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
No, thank you, Jennifer. That was great. I would love to hear your comments, questions, critiques, and thanks for listening as well.
There's no questions. I just wanted to make a plug. PBS Tonight has a TV show on their Need to Know. It's a Need to Know is the name of the show, where they're going to have footage. It's a whole program on how Border Patrol agents have killed up to 8 people since 2010, and there have been no investigations. And so the show kind of has footage of some of these horrific beatings. And then there's a campaign. If you go to bringjusticehome.us, they have an entire campaign where they're asking the Obama administration to have DOJ look into and to investigate these complaints of these deaths of people who've occurred along the border, half of them who've been minors.
Sure, sir.
My question's for you. You're saying between 2005 and 2011, we've seen a decrease in migrants of 61%. Those include the bodies that they find in the deserts. In terms of people coming across, has decreased 61% or just the ones apprehended live?
The ones apprehended live have decreased. The bodies are unfortunately slightly up over that period, if you count the Border Patrol statistics. But we're talking, 400 or 500 bodies versus apprehension numbers that are in the 100,000s at the beginning of the period in the millions. So that didn't affect the overall percentage. But bodies are unfortunately constant, which means we don't have great numbers here, but it means that your probability of dying is greater now than it was in the past.
And that's because we pushed.
We assume that's because people are going to more dangerous.
We're pushing that migrants into dangerous parts of the area.
Increased fencing, increased patrols, increased surveillance means, you're going to go to the most rugged, dangerous, remote places where your chances of survival are simply less. And search and rescue capabilities and water stations and beacons are actively discouraged.
You've given us a very good report on the state of the border, but my question is, what are your proposals for managing the border more effectively and more efficiently? You mentioned that the creation of another agency or more agencies wouldn't be the solution, but what are your proposals in this respect?
We don't necessarily recommend a cut in the overall budget, certainly not an increase. But within that budget, one thing we heard a lot was more blue, less green, meaning more money and resources for the Office of Field Operations, which mans the ports of entry. And we don't recommend less green, which is Border Patrol's uniform color, but certainly the ports of entry need a lot more because so much passes through there. The officials at those booths, which is not a very sexy-looking job, but it's crucial, are under enormous pressure to reduce wait times and allow commerce to pass through. At the same time, they've got to watch for inbound drugs, terrorists, or trafficked migrants, and southbound drugs. Well, not drugs. Southbound guns. Sorry, and bulk cash. So that's a big one: is to beef up OFO. Another one is we have to really question the 1989 decision to give the U.S. Armed Forces a lead role in interdicting narcotics, including on U.S. soil at the borders. That was assumed to be sort of an emergency response to the wave of drugs and crack cocaine and things that were happening in the late 1980s, early 1990s. 23 years later, we now have a very large semi-permanent military role, although it's still not very well integrated into the civilian DHS or DOJ efforts.
Is that Guard?
I'm talking about the National Guard. I'm also talking about Joint Task Force North, which the Northern Command component that isn't all that visible. It does a lot of things like construction projects and a lot of support for law enforcement agencies, but a lot of that support involves surveillance at the border, including surveillance of U.S. citizens if there's a counter-drug nexus. So that can be de-emphasized. We would put a lot more resources into search and rescue and similar humanitarian efforts. I mean, there's no excuse to have 400-plus people dying on our soil in our wilderness every year. Any other things you can go around there? Those are some of our preliminary things we found there.
Cindy. One other question of clarification, because I'm not sure if I heard you correctly, and the other is another question. You said something about, we all know that El Paso is one of the safest cities in the United States. But did you say that, like, Tucson, that's not necessarily true, like in Tucson and some of the Arizona border areas and stuff? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up.
I heard that correctly. And then my other question is, speaking of the Inter-American Commission, the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights put out a very strong and very critical report regarding the treatment of migrants in the United States. And as someone who actually pays attention to what the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights reports on Latin America countries and practices, I was wondering whether you had heard anything about how the United States was responding to that report and whether or not it was taking up any of the recommendations or directives.
I'll do the first question. I don't know as much about the second. But I'm glad you brought that up, Cindy, about the homicide rates and spillover. Tucson actually has the highest homicide rate of any city within 100 miles of the border, but it's only 9 per 100,000, which is higher than New York City. The national is 4.5 or 5, and that's as high as it gets. When you take all border cities, and their homicide rate is, I believe, 3.2. It's in the report. The national homicide rate is 4.5. So they're actually safer than the United States. They're actually have lower homicide rates than their states as well. However, those states are getting safer too. The four border states since 2005 saw their violent crime rates go down by 11% and their homicide rates go down by 20% since 2005. So why then, and I didn't bring this up and I should have, why then do folks like Jan Brewer, John McCain, John Kyle, Rick Perry, why are they always saying that there's a crisis on the border and that, you know, the violence is spilling over in a big way? Sure, some of it's politics, and I think, you know, Barack Obama and Janet Napolitano would try to say that it's politics. Some of it is also rural-urban. I didn't mention this. The folks in the cities along the border generally do feel safer and often are quite angry about the way that their cities are being portrayed as dangerous. In more remote areas, where you have a very sparse population, where most of the population is ranchers, ranchers do say they're feeling less safe, that the people, you know, they've always had migrants crossing through their territory, and they do feel that some of the migrants crossing these days are more menacing. The actual incidents, there have been a couple that have gotten a lot of attention. They're not a lot of actual incidents, but there's a feeling there that it is. Whether politics plays a role there too, and that more remote areas tend to be more red counties than the urban counties, I don't know. We didn't really get to say that. But there's that feeling. Also, the other exception to spillover to some extent is the very southern southeast tip of Texas, where the Zetas are running the show on the other side of the border in Mexico, and where the trafficking efforts are more aggressive. We haven't seen a lot of violence, but a more frequency of incidents, although still the homicide rates overall are rather low.
And then just to comment, that is something we hope to look at in our next the study. This is not the end of what WOLA's work on border and then migration issues, and I think one area we did want to put more emphasis in what actually are the different dynamics in the other part of the border, particularly with East Southern Texas, because of the situation in Mexico in terms of security and as added to the Zetas control over Tamaulipas, a good part of Tamaulipas.
Right.
In terms of the Inter-American Commission, a few years ago, there was a thematic hearing on treatment of migrants in ICE detention facility here in the United States. Since then, since they wrote their report, they did their own visits, and since the commission came out with the report, there have been a series of working group meetings. So the U.S. government has agreed to sit down and meet with the NGOs, the petitioners, who had filed these complaints. So they regularly have meetings. In fact, we just found out this week that the government is finally willing to give us a lot of data that we've been requesting for years, kind of through this commission mechanism. Specifically on the kinds of alternatives to detention that the U.S. is doing, what kinds of alternatives are doing, the numbers for alternatives and the success rates. Are people showing up to court when they go through these alternatives? So as a follow-up, we had this thematic hearing on the treatment, mostly by border protection, what happens to the migrants kind of along the border and their short-term hold facilities. So the idea is that hopefully the commission is going to agree to do their own visits to this area as well, to the border as well, and that we can continue these working group meetings with Customs and Border Protection as well, like we have been with ICE. So kind of continue this working groups, and then we don't know if they're going to do their own report on this issue or a separate report on this issue or not, but it's something that the Commission's very concerned of because there's been so many human rights violations being alleged along this area. So we're hoping that this is going to be we're going to follow the same path that they did with the ICE working group.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but Agent Fisher was at a hearing in Congress in February and actually, I think, in response to questions about abuses by Border Patrol, certainly made a comment that hasn't happened before of, yes, we're concerned that they're alarming and we're taking these seriously. And I think maybe at least a more recognition of the problem is an important step forward in terms of looking at these abuses. And I think, again, thanks to a lot of the work that the groups have been doing on documenting the abuse, like the added momentum of this is something that's not just a case of a few bad apples within the agency as much as kind of a practice that's sort of permitted, if not encouraged, in terms of a way to discourage migrants from coming back into the United States.
what was really promising about Agent Fisher's response was just a few weeks before that, Secretary Napolitano had testified before Congress, and Representative Roybal Allard had asked her about another report that had come out, Culture of Cruelty, where they had interviewed 13,000 migrants after they had been repatriated to Mexico. And she kind of dismissed the report and dismissed the numbers, saying, you know, well, every once in a while there's going to be a problem, but she seriously doubted that this report was accurate or that this information was accurate. So just a few weeks later, having Agent Fisher make that comment, we feel like is really getting good momentum at this point. The agency is listening because there's more and more reports. There's, like, this report, No More Deaths, this footage tonight on the PBS special. I think they're realizing it's time to really take these complaints seriously.
Sure, sir.
Hey, my name is Johan Berghassel with the Stimson Center. Adam, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you mentioned that you had seen an increase overlap interlinkages between human smugglers, illicit trafficking of drugs, and criminal enterprise more broadly in the region. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that exacerbates the broader problems, how these groups are interconnected, how they leverage each other's financial resources and trafficking groups and whatnot?
It varies across the border in different areas, but one thing we do see is that drug cartel is a misnomer in general in Mexico. You have to call them organized crime groups because they branched out well beyond simply trafficking drugs. The same group, like the CETAS is a real pioneer here. The same group that is shipping drugs across the border also has achieved control over kidnapping for ransom, extortion of small shop owners, as well as human trafficking, and will exercise monopoly control over that. I mean, that, according to anecdotal accounts we heard in a few places, in that East Texas, Tamaulipas area, CETAS maintain alconcillos, watchers, along the Rio Grande every couple miles, where they are watching constantly to see who crosses unauthorized, and then they crack down on them, which is... it's like a second layer of border control, really. almost an East German level of control that they are maintaining right now. Now, that's not uniform across the border. We heard different things in El Paso. It still seemed to be somewhat possible to be a mom and pop coyote helping people across the border without ties to organized crime, although that's probably weaker than it used to be. In Arizona, we heard that El Chapo, the Sinaloa cartel, has total control of everything, like Maureen was saying. San Diego still seem to have some independent folks running. But certainly, it's more... You know, we got asked yesterday, in fact, to what extent is this strengthening of organized crime and diversification a result of the U.S. buildup? We're not really equipped to say that that's happened. It's been more of a parallel process, we think, because organized crime in Mexico has gotten so strong, really starting in the mid-90s when the Colombian cartel started to be taken down, but then particularly after the PRI left office.
Just a comment in terms of the U.S. side, too, because I think we focus, obviously, the horrendous numbers of kidnapping of migrants in Mexico are, the biggest source of concern. But there have been, I think, accounts and credible accounts of kidnapping of migrants in the United States, I think, based on two different types of practices. One is the smugglers basically keeping their migrants for more time, so holding, particularly Arizona's had the biggest problem of this, migrants being held in safe houses and being tortured or calling their families to be extorted to send more money to let the person be released into the United States, and then probably somewhat more isolated accounts, which is one smuggling group kidnapping someone else's migrants in the United States and Arizona. There have been cases in Texas and holding them for ransom here as well. So I think it's not as big a problem as in Mexico, but talking to the Tucson Sheriff's Office and others, they certainly recognize it as being something that occurs maybe, you know, not every day, but something that's more than an isolated occurrence. And I think, secondly, some of the research being done in Arizona by the University of Arizona researchers are interviewing migrants that have been deported to all these different shelters on the Mexico side, where they have accounts of migrants being held in Phoenix, for example, in safe houses, where they will say, we've also, in the same house, there were drugs, there were weapons, there was cash. So I think, again, that's sort of where you can say these maybe aren't just human smugglers as much as kind of part of a broader organized criminal group with, obviously, connections to Mexico.
Okay, let's call this to order. Thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate you coming. If you don't have a copy of the report, it's right here. And thanks for your time.
You.
Now, that was audio from last week's launch in the Congress of Beyond the Border Buildup. Thank you for listening to WOLA's Latin America Today. Please keep listening. We're up on iTunes, and please keep visiting WOLA's website, www.wola.org. If you're finding these podcasts useful, please do consider making a donation to keep us going. You can also find WOLA on Facebook or on Twitter at WOLA_ORG. Hasta pronto.